Good morning. Welcome to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Good to be talking with you again this week. Hope you're all doing well. We have as our guest today Phil DeLuca, who is an expert in his own right on loving relationships, and he has a very unique approach that he's going to tell us about. Welcome, Phil.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you, and I'm so excited to learn about your work. So if you could tell our audience a little bit about yourself, a little bit of your background and what you do.
Okay, I'm a licensed clinical social worker and been doing marriage relationship counseling for 40 years, over probably close to 50,000 situations. And I found initially that the express yourself and talk it through communication approaches back in 77 when I just graduated from graduate school, I didn't deliver what they promised. Matter of fact, when I use them with clients and in my own life, they seem to make conflict worse. So what I decided to do was figure out why and how, and come up with something that did work. So I spent the next 30, 40 years figuring out what went wrong and what I can do about it to make it better. So I came up with an alternative approach. But while that was going on, I was also having some chronic health problems like arthritis and a number of others. And so I started saying, I'm too young to be getting sick. So I started researching alternative health reasons for that and how to cure it, and which I subsequently did. And then I realized that the same biological processes that are going on that cause disease in bodies also causes them in relationships. And that was the aha moment where I discovered the same process that causes disease, inflammation in the body, is the same thing that causes diseased relationships. And I discovered that the express yourself, talk it through, get your anger out, never go to bed mad at each other, always be honest and open about what you're feeling, you're entitled to it, stay in touch with your anger, is highly inflammatory. And it's causing both physiologically as well as relationship and emotionally. So what I discovered was that the conventional approaches produce diseased bodies in addition to diseased relationships. I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's a horrible system. It doesn't work. And what it does is it causes people to give up on relationships that they don't have to. They end relationships that don't have to be ended, and that's the tragic part. It also gets translated over into parent-child issues because concurrent with Express Yourself, which was becoming very popular, it was talk to your kids. Always talk it through with your kids. That's based on the same model. And if you've ever tried to talk to a child, a teenager or a younger child that's out of control, what you end up with is two people out of control, and then frequently the whole family gets drawn in. So
what you're saying basically is that to express your anger or to try and talk to somebody when they're upset, in your experience, you find that to not have been helpful and to make matters worse and to maybe possibly increase inflammation and disease in the body. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, not only possibly, it's virtually guaranteed. Because what happens is when we get upset, the fight-or-flight response kicks in, and that's inflammation in the body. And that systemically wires the changes. It impacts every system in our body. Our lens, our perception darkens. We become volatile, irrational, combative. So here's the scenario. You ever seen somebody who was calm 1 minute? And they get upset, and they're a whole other person. It's like an alien enters their body, and you're like, who is this? What happened to the other person? And then they get calm, they catch a nap, or they laugh about something, and the alien leaves, and they're back to who they are, who they were before. That's exactly
the kind of expression you're talking about is you're saying put some caution on expressing yourself when you're very, very upset. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying don't even put some caution. Stop. don't talk about it too, you get calmer.
Yeah.
Get away. Get calmer if you can. Get away. Get calmer, and then talk about it. The research is real clear. Talking through when you're very upset, when you're upset, is the worst possible way to resolve any problems. But people that try that don't need me to tell them that. They know it doesn't work because I see couples all the time coming in, and they say, yeah, I've tried that. I've been to 5 other counselors. I've read every book, and they encourage me to talk it through when we're upset, and it just makes it worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So what you're saying is talk about it and communicate, but do so from a place of calmness and perhaps even kindness, but you have to settle yourself down before you can do that. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and you know, the latest...
How do you, in your work with your clients then, that really there's an issue of soothing and grounding here. How to get soothed and grounded so that you can communicate in a constructive and loving way. How do you advise that that our audience sort of pursue that when they're really upset?
Well, I came up with a five-step alternative, five-step approach.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, one is be aware of what's going on. There's a time to talk and there's a time not. When you're upset and or your partner is upset, that's the worst possible time to, quote, talk it through. So that's when that alien we just talked about is present either in you or them. And actually what that means biologically is that our amygdala, which is behind our head, it's our survival brain, behind our ears, our survival brain has taken over, and it's called amygdala hijack. It has hijacked our cerebral cortex, the front part of our brain, logic, reason, love, understanding, conflict resolution, and it's hijacked it, and now it's volatile, irrational, conflict-seeking, and provocative. Not a good time to be trying to work out issues where love and caring and closeness is involved. So that's one step. Step one is be aware. Most people have lost that awareness because we now know from neuroplasticity that the brain wires around our thoughts. And as we stay, quote, stay in touch with our anger, our front part of our brain actually shrinks and the back part of our brain grows because the brain is like a muscle. And so now people get stuck on what's known as amygdala hijack, lock, where they stay always angry, ruminating negative thoughts, constantly anxious, always seeing, always defensive and attacking. So the brain
has
been wired.
The first step is mindfulness then, right? Just be very mindful and aware of when you do get hijacked, when you're aroused and when you're in a angry or upset or negative state, just to be aware of that. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, that's a step one, which can be some people get that right away and some people don't. So step two now, put in a pause switch. Pause it. Put in a pause switch before you say something that you're going to regret and the other party may never get over. Get away initially. So it'd be good if you could talk through in a calm way, but you know, initially people don't have that skill. So get away, get calmer. That leads to step three. How am I going to get calmer? Detox those. I call it detoxic. That's step three. Get calmer by exercise. Works off those chemicals. Reading a good book. Looking at a show that makes you laugh. Laughter's really good for that. Calming music. Doing a gratitude journal. There's a whole bunch of things. Doing meditation. Picking up the Bible and doing some spiritual reading or whatever particular spiritual path you're on, doing altruistic acts, connecting with people, touch releases endorphins calm down the inflammation process that's circulating around in us, the cortisol and adrenaline and such. And now when you're calmer, then re-engage with the other person and communicate.
Is that step four?
Yes. Communicate. Step four, now talk. Now's the time to talk it through because you're dealing with front brains of front brain, cerebral cortex to cerebral cortex, conflict-resolving brain to conflict-resolving brain. And then step five is how to navigate through provocation. What do you do when the other party's upset and they don't want to disengage? That's a really common one. So
yeah, what do you do?
Well, that's a little more elaborate to discuss, to talk about, but basically, you got to be aware of when they're in that state. And when we're upset, our primitive reptilian brain is in control of us. That's what I call that amygdala hijack. So our survival brain has hijacked us. And that reptilian brain is only looking for one thing. When we get into that mindset, we're only looking for, it's a conflict-seeking brain. All right? So it's seeking conflict. That's why when the other party's upset and you try to disengage, well, when the other party, have you noticed when the other party's upset, they know how to push your buttons and they go at it, trying to push, push, push? Why are they working so hard to provoke an argument? Here you are, you're like, hey, this is going to get into an argument. Let's disengage and return when it's calmer. And they don't do that. You go into the other room, they follow you in there, you close the door, they come in, you lock the door, they bang and scream through the door, you try to leave the house, they block the door, they threaten that the locks will be changed if you come back. Why won't they let you leave? You're trying to preserve our love. You're trying to keep us close. You're trying to prevent things from getting said that's going to kill us, kill our relationship. And why won't they let that happen? Seems so unreasonable. Well, survival brain does not, has no reason in it. That's front brain. Back brain is conflict seeking. And from when we're upset, we just see the other party as the enemy. Or even more than that, a meal. You know, we all turn into crocodiles, basically. So the meal is escaping. That's why they don't want you to leave, because they're not going to get the conflict they were seeking. So here's where conventional approaches really screw up and amplify conflict. So they encourage you to talk it through then, or you're running from the problem. Tell them how you feel. Tell them all those nasty things in that primitive mind that's in control of you is feeling and thinking and seething about. Put it out there. So they put it out there. No rhyme or reason, stuff from the past, noxious words, anything to hurt the other party gets thrown out. I call it the feeding frenzy stage, like two drowning people trying to stand on each other to survive, and they both go down. And eventually they pull apart, and now you have to pay the costs. Guilt, shame, regret, a lot of negative ruminating thoughts, a lot of bad things said you have to recover from. And then there's relationship costs, communications more conflictual after that than before. Over time, sex becomes a battleground, a ritual, a non-existent. You don't like him as much. You don't like their company as much. And then you have to pay the health costs. Yeah. We now know.
So,
go ahead.
So, Phil, one thing in my couples counseling work over the years, I've coached with people to say, something like, look, honey, we're both really upset right now. We're not going to be able to resolve this when we're upset. We both need to calm down. Look, I'm going to take a time out. I'm going to separate because I love you and because I care about our relationship. I'm going to separate until we can both get calmer, because this is not going to help us. And let's plan on talking again in an hour and checking in and seeing if each of us has calmed down. And if not, then we'll take a further time out. That seems to have worked well for me in my work with couples over the years. What is your thought? Yeah. Have you had that kind of experience?
Well, yes and no. That's the same theory I'm talking about. The problem is putting that into place. When somebody's upset and they've had this hijack occur, and you ask their permission to break off, my experience is you're not going to get it. All that's going to do is, for most people, is send them into high gear on this.
Well, it almost has to be negotiated ahead of time, is my thought. If you try and do that and it hasn't been agreed to previously, then it generally won't work,
Well, here's the problem.
What do you recommend in that situation? How would you handle that? What do you recommend to your clients?
Well, I remember, I would recommend, so communication is two parts. You have to be in a conflict-seeking, a conflict resolution mindset, and they do also.
Right.
And if they are not, then there are ways to get around that. And the latest mind-body science says communicating through that mindset is the worst possible way. It almost guarantees conflict. So one way is if you got to disengage, don't seek their permission. Just say, hey, let's revisit this later after dinner, and then disengage. And then you have to plan on the disengagement. Where are you going to go to escape? Because most people will get followed. Men and women will follow them around. And finishing the argument, and matter of fact, they'll get insulted that you tried to stop the argument. There are other ways around it. Touch releases endorphins. Endorphins calms down that fight-or-flight mechanism and reengages the front brain. Sometimes you can give them a hug. Sometimes you can't because they won't let you get near them. Calming music will do it. Put on calming music. Saying, let's go look at this show, distracting their mind, there's a number of things that you can do to disengage that back brain, which is conflict-seeking. But I see a lot of people coming to me who went to a lot of other counselors and read every book out there, and they basically it's not working because they're trying to talk their way through these problems, and it doesn't work in the majority of cases that are intense conflict. It works for a while.
I agree with you. I think there's a need to disengage, absolutely. And you've mentioned just disengaging and saying, I'm going to disengage. I think if you can plan that ahead of time and so that it's not experienced as abandonment, that seems very important. But I like what you said about, you know, the music or doing something distracting. Let's take a break from this and change the channel. Or like you said, giving somebody a hug, just telling them that you love them. Have you seen that work as well, Ben?
Oh, yeah, that works. One of the things, let's go back to planning it out ahead of time. See, this is the trap I think a lot of conventional approach sets people up to lose. It's a lose-lose kind of situation. And it's a trap that makes it worse. Especially most books out there and advice given from well-intentioned friends. And that is, so here we are, we're both in our front brain engaged. Okay, so we're going to agree. Here's the scenario. You're in the therapist's office, you agree on these rules. Okay, we're not going to use toxic words. We're going to break off when it gets past a certain point. We're going to stay focused, right? They go out to the car. The battery won't start. They got to get home because the babysitter's running. It's got to leave. They're getting into a panic. The fight or flight response kicks in. The back brain hijacks the front brain, and the very things they agreed to do, they cannot do, because what happens when this hijack occurs? Front brain actually turns off. We lose up to 75% of our blood flow, so you can't access those rules. And so they do the very thing they promised they wouldn't do. They feel horrible afterwards. They go back to the therapist. The therapist says, okay, let's rehearse this again. They fail again, as they will, because you cannot, you know, the front brain falls asleep. It's like a leg that has no blood flow. You can't get up and run on that blood flow on that leg while it's cut off. And if you had a coach that says, come on, go, 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 and you're like, you don't understand. My leg's asleep. All I can do is drag it. It's a dead limb. I'd say fire the coach and get somebody who knows what the heck they're talking about. They rehearse it. The time comes. The front brain shuts off. We now know it shuts off. It falls asleep. The back brain becomes the Hulk. Front brain becomes Pee Wee Herman. They do the very things they wouldn't promise to do, and it reinforces their sense of failure.
Okay, well, I hear you. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, Phil, and continue this discussion, and hopefully get back more to your discussion of how to navigate through propagation and give people real-life examples of alternative ways to do that after the break. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. sounds good.
Okay, great. Well, you're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, with our guest, Phil DeLuca, who is a relationship coach and author. And stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. We have our guest, relationship coach and author, Philip DeLuca. And welcome back, Phil.
Oh, thank you. This is fun.
Yeah. So you were talking about how, you know, coaching and couples therapy, sometimes you plan ahead with your frontal lobes about how to handle when people get limbically hijacked or amygdala hijacked, yeah, and they're upset and their frontal lobes are shut down, and how oftentimes planning for that may not work because people's frontal lobes are shut down. So what do you do differently in your therapy? You've given this five-step process here, but if you're working with somebody who hasn't worked on this five-step process and you need to navigate through a provocation, you've mentioned disengaging unilaterally, suggesting a distraction, suggesting maybe giving a hug to sort of give them the message nonverbally that you love them. Are there other things that you can do when you feel provoked?
Okay, so let's clarify. Are we working with a couple that's actively working on this, or do you have one person? A lot of times, majority of situations, unfortunately, at least initially, you only have one person willing to work on it. Now, conventional approaches require two people. So you pretty much eliminated a huge swath of people in requiring two people. My approach, at least initially, and to a good part of it, only requires one person. As a matter of fact, in my experience, it's pretty rare that you get two people working at the same speed and at the same pace with the same motivation. Usually you have one that has to lead and take the ball and run with it, and the other party comes across kicking and screaming, getting dragged behind. That's the most common. Sometimes the other party, yeah, won't even participate at all. And then you're in.
What do you do if it's unilateral then? What do you recommend?
Well, first of all, you've got to get a hand on your own triggers, what's setting you off, controlling that fight-or-flight response, and then learning to stay in your front versus back brain. Once you have that, that's the first four steps. Then I move people to step five, which is, and I do that really quickly because what people will say is, I know I have a temper, or I know I'm argumentative, but my other party, when they get upset, they'll just poke, and before you know it, I blow. So you have to get how to navigate through the other party's provocative behavior pretty quickly, otherwise the whole thing's going to fail. Because even if they're working on themselves, but the other party gets upset and provokes them constantly, you know, it's just not going to work. So I saw a man this morning who was in which this is our second session, and that's the exact process he talked about, was his significant other gets upset and just pushes his button, and then he blows. So he's got, quote, the problem with the temper, because the other party never sees that their provocative behavior is helping provoke the temper. So what I told him last week, I said, so here's some skill stuff. Let's get you starting to throttle back your temper. And then once you start, as you work on that, I'm going to show you how to steer through her attempts to provoke an argument. And that's what we spend today on, because it's really important to give them both the whole package initially and then work on the pieces as you go along. Because what they'll immediately do is focus on, well, what about them? I try to do this. I try to get control of my temper, and they follow me in the next room. They get in my face. They bring up toxic issues. So basically what I pointed out to him was, let me ask you this question. Who has the most power in the interaction, the person who's in front brain or the person in back brain, and why? Why do they have that power in that interaction? Is that something you want to give a shot at?
Okay.
Answering?
Yeah. So So you have somebody following you into the other room. So what did you recommend to this person on how to deal with the provocation, on how to deal with his wife in terms of her provoking him?
Well, what I said was, I asked him that very question, and he typically gave me the answer that I hear most often was, the person in the front brain, why? Because they can reason their way through. And I said, you're close, but you're not there. And I said, you have to understand what's going on in order to steer through this. And so then I gave him the example. So you have an addict and a pusher. And the pusher has the last cocaine in the country. So the addict comes up to the pusher and says, here's the money, give me the cocaine, I'm a good client of yours. And the pusher says, I'm not giving this to you, I never liked you, we're out of cocaine, go to Mexico and get it. So what happens? The pusher goes through, the addict goes through withdrawal. They get aggressive, they get loud, I'll kill you, I'll rape your daughter, I'll kill her, I'll rape her again, I'll burn your family, your house down. And he's like, you're not going to bother me, I've got bodyguards all over the place, I control the neighborhood, you're not getting anywhere near my family, so get away from me. So who holds the power in that interaction and why? Well, the reason, the pusher holds it because he's got what the other party wants, the cocaine. And as soon as he gives that up, he gives his power up. Okay? So there's the analogy. So how does this translate? Somebody's upset. The other party's upset and you're calm. Who holds the power in that interaction and why? The answer is the person who's calm, and this is where people don't get it, but once they do, it opens up huge horizons. The person who's calm because the person who is upset is looking for conflict. The rest, like the addict, is all noise and smoke and mirrors to get the conflict, the fix, the adrenaline that's going on in their system, and they need to be satisfied. So as long as you don't give them the conflict back, you're winning. And the reason they're escalating is because they're losing the battle. The prey is escaping. When we go into our reptilian brain, the research is real clear. We see the other party as nothing more than a meal. It's a survival mechanism. And so when you're trying to disengage from an argument, the reason they don't want you to disengage, they threaten you, they follow you around, is because the prey is escaping. You follow where I'm going with this?
Yes, yes, you've said that before, but you haven't really given a practical solution for what to do when they're following you around yet. You haven't
okay.
yet. Told our
so what I do is I walk people through that. So if you disengage, okay, so we're going to deal with this later when we're calmer. The other party is going to follow you, so they go to the other room. Well, you know they're going to follow you in the room. Can you close the door? If that's not going to work, can you lock it? No, because they'll bang and scream through the door. So leave the house. Well, if you leave the house, well, how are they going to threaten you? If you leave the house, the lock's going to be changed. You'll be divorced like that five-time low-life loser mother of yours. You just keep on going, keeping the perspective of what's going on. You're not losing. You're actually, they're going through withdrawal from the fix of conflict, the adrenaline that's flowing through them. So you're actually, it's like somebody going on a diet and going through the cravings. And if you know that the cravings are not bad, it's a sign that I'm not eating chocolate, sneaking it on the side, that's really important. So my approach is a two-part approach. One is to educate, re-educate them about the fallacies and the shortcomings of conventional communication approaches, which we just did a quickie about, and then introduce them to an alternative approach. So then walk them through that alternative approach, which, again, we just did a real quick version of that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think that we're going to take a little bit of a break here, but I can think of some other things to add to that at least have worked for me personally, including empathizing with somebody suffering, not taking it personally so that you don't get triggered by their anger and attack.
Yeah, yeah.
And having compassion for the person who's upset and rather than reacting defensively when you're attacked. But maybe we can talk about that a little bit more after
sure.
our
yes.
break.
Yeah, those are all
How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. And we have with us our guest, Phil DeLuca, a relationship coach and expert, talking about how to handle amygdala or limbic hijacking. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, your host. We have with us Philip DeLuca, a relationship coach and an expert at managing relational conflict. Welcome back, Phil.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I really like your five-step approach and the importance when you do feel provoked to disengage and until both parties have calmed down. I think before the break, we talked a little bit about disengaging. I'm wondering if there are some ways to disengage. I'm thinking about not taking things personally and showing empathy and compassion in our hearts for people who are attacking us, perhaps because they're so upset. Do you do any coaching on those internal spiritual practices?
Oh yeah, that's an important component of it. So like in step one. I ask people, what's the signs that your fight or flight response is kicking in? People tell me I could feel my sinuses flush, my heart pumping harder, my muscles tense for action. That's the sign initially. See, I like to get people to where they can be strong enough that they can talk through it while things are tense. And they can get to the place, the other side of that wall that they've been bouncing off of prior. But people mm-hmm. don't have that skill or actually the mental ability initially because of neuroplasticity. They just don't have the brain cells. So this is a transient step where it's a bridge step where get calmer, which we talked about some ways to detox, listen to calming music, turn down the lights, listen to meditation. Whatever it is that you get focused on, you're sitting on a beach, hugging a baby, whatever the case may be, get calm and then re-engage. So the first step, see, the thing with empathy and talking through that, you have to be in a calm state to do that. And if you've been hijacked by your reptilian brain, you're not going to be able to do it. And, you know, I have really good self-control in that area, but when my loved one, my wife, gets upset and she starts glaring at me like I'm evil incarnate and saying horrible things and bringing up the past and just getting real nasty, I reach a point where I can't be empathic anymore, so that's the point that I have to disengage. And everything I'm saying gets twisted and distorted and comes back to clobber me. So I find empathy works as long as I can stay in control, and it's real important that people monitor that, and most people cannot stay there. Probably 95% of people, when they're getting flailed at by their loved one, they cannot stay in an empathetic, controlled place, at least not initially. It takes a lot of practice.
Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing I think is that the impersonality, in a way, and empathy, though, the more that you practice that, I think along with sort of self-love and self-nurturing, oftentimes when people attack us, in my experience, The vulnerability is that they're pushing a button around us being good enough, that we are enough, and that we are good and lovable despite our faults and imperfections. I'm thinking about a situation with my wife, who, a wonderful person, Linda, who I had made a mistake on a form because I had rushed through it and hadn't paid attention. And Linda said to me in a frustrated way, you know, I can't believe, I don't understand why you why you did that. Very frustrated.
Yeah.
And the button that it pushed in me was, you know, that I sometimes am careless because of my not attending to details as carefully as I should, which triggered in me an underlying feeling of, well, you know, I'm flawed. I have this defect, and so then that feeling of defensiveness and hurt arose in me. And as I with practice, I think coming to a place of saying, you know what, I am good and lovable and whole despite her reaction, despite the truth of my faults and flaws. And that's not the issue here. The issue is that I did something unintentionally that caused her a lot of upset and frustration. And so to not then get provoked because of grounding it in my own goodness, despite my flaws, that then allowed me, out of my sense of security and out of a sense of impersonality, seeing that really her reaction was about her and her expectations and not about me, only partially in what I did provoked her, but I'm not responsible for how she was provoked. Then, and this is all very quick. This is happening within, you know, 2 or 3 seconds. But then having empathy and go, oh, God, I see how frustrating and upsetting that was for you, honey. I'm so sorry. That kind of process, I think, can really help to decrease how provoked we feel when people attack us. I don't know. What role does self-love, you think, play in giving us sort of some protection to being provoked?
Yeah, that issue there, I would approach it a little differently. And
oh, that's great. Tell me.
Yeah, I'm not big on self-love. I'm big on self-control. And sometimes self-love is required for that. But the way I would see that issue is you can only do that process of self-love if your front brain is engaged. If your back brain has hijacked your front brain, you're not going to be able to think those thoughts you just mentioned because, remember, front brain shuts off. Higher functioning decision-making, executive decision-making, we just don't have that ability. So I would ask the person to monitor what it is that's triggering it, their own internal biochemistry, and work at keeping that at a low level, and they can stay connected in that way. And the way I do that is, one, giving them education about what's the biochemistry going on and trying to take the personal element out of it. The other part of that I would ask, I'd flip it over, is taking a look at what your wife, in that case, why she jumped to those conclusions, and can she frame it in a different way in the future? So I would kind of expand out the lens on that.
Well, Phil, it's been great having you on the show and hearing your wisdom and your unique perspective. How can our audience learn more about you? Do you have a website or any products that you have?
It's called GoBeyondTalkTherapy.com, and I have a free 50-minute webinar, "Stop Your Fighting Tonight," where I look at the shortcomings of conventional models, and I provide my alternative. And people should be able to stop arguing when they get done with that webinar. It's got about 100+. PowerPoints, I use different masks and props to make my point. And
wow, great.
I also have a 5-part course.
You have a book out, too, called Solo Partner, Repairing Your Relationship on Your Own. Is that right?
Yeah. And what I did was so that's available, but that's kind of dated. This is, I have a 5-part course. It's real inexpensive, 4 hours, $169, where I walk people through this whole process. But what I discovered, actually, is that initial free webinar is enough for most people to get the whole process.
Well, our time has come to a close, so we have to stop. But, Phil, it's been great to have you. People listening, go to GoBeyondTalkTherapy.com. And this is Dr. Michael McGee, Dr. Mike, I will be right back with a final segment, so stay with us. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee, your host. By the way, if you want to learn more about me and my work, you can always go to howtolove.com, and that will bring you to my website. So very interesting listening to Phil DeLuca talk about his work. I thought there was a lot of wisdom in what he was saying, that I thought it was very interesting. He talked about the connection between mind and body, and that diseased bodies and diseased relationships could sort of go hand in hand. And that really, really is true. I think perhaps 80% of what primary care doctors deal with in medicine is rooted in relationship problems, relationship conflicts, difficulties in feeling lovable and in loving and being loved. And that leads to all sorts of problems like hypertension and diabetes and aches and pains like he experienced. So very, very interesting. I think the other thing is his ideas about talking when you're in limbic hijack, when one or both people are very emotionally aroused and frontal lobes are shut down, is very, very wise, very, very wise. And it really is good to get to a place where you're calm and grounded and soothed before dealing with conflicts. So his five-step approach, I thought, was very good. Very good, yeah. So, I'm thinking about wanting to talk a little bit more about the issue of appreciation, and, which is part of the three A's of awakening to love. Remember, the three A's are attending, which is to ask, what is this? Moment by moment, present awareness. And then appreciating, which is practicing an attitude of unconditional, what I call radical reverence for this moment and for yourself and for other people. And then the third A of awakening to love is to act with love, including abstaining from harm. So as far as the second A of appreciation, which we talked about a little bit last week, there's really the issue of appreciating pain, which is really probably the most challenging thing. We, as animals, we're programmed to seek out pleasure and avoid pain. And what our minds do is they judge painful experiences as bad. And that's the mistake that really a practice of appreciation is about. We're sort of programmed by nature by default to judge painful experiences as bad. And that judging leads to a great deal of suffering because of labeling pain as bad. There's this idea that people have had of positive and negative emotions, and those terms are probably not helpful. The idea being that all emotions are positive because they're messengers to us, even depression and anxiety. They're messengers to us to tell us that something's wrong that we need to pay attention to. So rather than thinking of emotions as positive or negative, it's probably better to think of them as either painful or pleasurable. And to really then look and appreciate the value of pain. This, again, really stems down to an appreciation that nature made us the way that nature has made us for a reason. And can we honor that humbly and transcend judging our experience as either good or bad? The idea is that whether painful or pleasurable, that this moment is sacred, that it is as it is, it is as it must and can only be. And when you're free of the labels of good or bad, then your suffering around the situation diminishes. You're still in pain, but you're suffering less because you have this reverent appreciation that this pain is there for a reason. So in a relationship conflict, there's obviously pain that occurs. And can we then appreciate, for example, that this pain has to do with our own yearning, say, to be valued and to be loved and to belong safely and securely to a couple, to a relationship, and that this pain comes from some degree of sense of being threatened or or being attacked, and it's a signal to us around the ego's desire for safety, comfort, and satisfaction and belonging. Then if you can look at it that way, then you can see it for what it is and appreciate that this is just your brain's attempt to try and take care of you and take care of your security. And when somebody else is really angry and attacking you, can you then appreciate, can you attend closely to them, and can you appreciate that they're attacking you or upset with you because of their own issues around feeling secure and safe and feeling that they need to do this to be able to protect themselves or to deal with the frustration that they have about getting something that they want from you, or to stop you from doing something that they feel will be harmful to them. Very, very important practices to engage in. I think, you know, underlying that is just this attitude of humility that, you know, we can certainly act to change the reality of things, but we are not in control of all of reality. And while we're a part of a sacred, loving life force, we are not all of life. We are but a very small part of what I call a vast, gracious, orderly dynamic, or G-O-D, gracious, orderly dynamic that is life. And when we practice appreciation, we humbly see and accept with gratitude the way things are, even when we're in great pain. We can change what we can, and then we can accept the rest. In this way, appreciation really does promote serenity. So it's so important that we practice this attitude of appreciation that is really fostered by the practice of attending, by looking closely and seeing very clearly how awesome and amazing this moment of consciousness, this precious moment of consciousness is. And when we do that, when we combine appreciation with attending or engage in what I call appreciative attending to this moment, then judgment is replaced by what I call discernment, is just seeing very clearly the way things are without judgment. With discernment, you can see the reality of things and respond intelligently with love, because there aren't any negative judgments. You're acting from a place of reverence rather than the opposite, which would be hatred. So appreciation is just a very, very deep topic, and we'll come back to this next week as well. But this is a part of creating the foundation of radical reverence out of which love springs. Great to have you on the show this week. Great to be talking about how to manage conflict. Certainly with the COVID epidemic, people have been in close quarters with each other, and there's been a marked increase in some households of domestic violence and conflict. So the skills that Phil DeLuca talked about today are really valuable for all of us to ponder. I hope you have a really good week, and I hope to hear that you will return and have a chance to connect with you again next week. Dr. Michael McGee, your host, thank you so much for joining us. Have a good week.